Hello, this is The Book Show on Apollo Bay Radio. My name's Brian Dwyer. With me is Lee Kelly. How are you, Lee?
I'm very well, thanks, Brian, on this nasty return to winter day.
Yes, yes. 30th of
perfect
August.
Perfect for reading.
Is a reading day. Our focus tonight will be on magic realism, but before we get to that, what have you been reading since we saw you?
Well, my guilty pleasure this week has been I read the new Harry Potter book.
Oh, well, you read all the old ones?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Because my son grew up with Harry Potter. They were about the same age.
Yeah.
And I can remember I used to read it to him. It's one of my fondest memories of you know, just a mother-son moment. We used to snuggle down and read, and he used to say to me as he was drifting off to sleep, "Don't you read on. Don't you read on." So, of course I would, because I'd get caught up in the story and I'd have to pretend. No, I didn't read anymore. This is all a surprise to me. So he's just had his 24th birthday, and I thought I'd give him the book for his birthday. And he brought it down. He hadn't started it, so I said, "Right, while you're here, I'm going to read it." So I just went in boots and all and finished.
We've been joined by Megan Harrison. We're talking about Harry Potter. Lee's read the latest. Well, how many have you read?
Child. I've
read
the play, is it?
Yeah. I have read them all. I haven't reread them like many people do. Like, for me, Harry Potter was, I mean, it's a fantastic series. Like, it really was. But it was all, you know, plot driven for me. I just wanted to find out what happened once it happened. I mean, I never thought J.K. Rowling was particularly good writer that you'd revisit. It was all story.
Mm. I did try her other two that she wrote after the series. I tried The Cuckoo's Calling and The Vacancy. The Vacancy she wrote under her own name, and The Cuckoo's Calling she wrote under a pseudonym as a male. I can't remember what it was. Mm. I read both of those, but they were sort of more adult fiction. Mm. Yeah, they didn't knock my socks off. They were really good page turners, you know, just a simple, kind of. But they read like they were very visual. I could imagine the BBC production of both of them. And I wondered, because she was very tied in with all of the movie production of all of her books.
Mm.
And, we're rereading them now to our kids, because we read them all as, adults. But we had to stop now, because they do get so dark quickly.
They do.
And Harper started probably a bit early, but she couldn't wait. She just wanted to keep knowing the next bit. But even she's, and I'm happy to
read
now.
I wondered about that, because I read the first one, The Philosopher's Stone, and loved it, but didn't feel the need to read any more. I felt I had the experience and enjoyed it. But
I've often thought, like, there are some really great ideas that I've returned to in discussions with the kids because they've read them all. Like, for example, the idea of dementors who suck all hope out of you. I mean, it's such an obvious parallel with depression, you know?
Yes.
And also boggarts, or I'll have said it wrong, Brian, if you'd read it, you'd have said something different. But the idea of something that you're really frightened of and the only way you can get rid of it is to think of something funny. You know, you have to laugh at it. Otherwise, Ron was, his was spiders, which mine would have been probably too.
Yeah.
But just that idea, you know, that you can actually have that conversation with someone who's read it and saying, that's just your thing. You've got to learn to laugh at it. They won't have any power over you.
There are lots of those little things. They're great. Mm. I don't know if there was enough to substitute, it constituted a nice world. But for the series, there wasn't enough of those nuggets.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's why I think there's the new film coming out, in the same world.
Yes.
Because I love the muggle divide.
Yes.
And that I would love to explore more than, because Harry Potter was fine. He was a nice kid, but he just became a really annoying teenager toward the end. Like, those books, they just got too long as well.
Yeah, they did get a bit long. Yeah. And the other idea that I always really liked was the idea of occlumency, which is control over your mind, you know, because in one of the later books, the way that he had to keep Voldemort out was Snape was supposed to teach him how to how to block out things from his mind. Oh. And that's also something that is, you know, it's a good mental health trick, you know, when something is bothering you.
And you could see why teenagers would be really interested in this stuff.
Yeah.
Yes.
So what they did with this play, I shouldn't come in early because we always have our best discussions before the radio starts. But I was saying, I when I was teaching, I used to try to teach kids the appropriate form to use for their writing, like it might have been poetic or it might have been prose or it might be, you know, whatever suited it, a letter, a diary, a memoir, whatever. And because each of them has their own strengths. So this one has been written as a collaboration with other people and it's in a play form, but it's a story. And so it doesn't really work as a play. Because a play, its strength is dialogue and movement, you know. And so, you know, it's not quite the same to have the stage direction saying, and now the Dementors appeared. You need the words.
Yes, that is interesting. I wonder why then did she think of doing it as a
stage? Well, I think it began as a play and she's morphed, you know, she's got involved in, I don't really know this, I didn't read the background to it, and so it's become, and then the publication of it comes with her sort of imprimatur because it uses her ideas.
It's a great money-making thing because even people who won't read it will go and see it.
Yes. And maybe she just needed a change from knocking out 600-page books too. You know.
And what also an honour to think that you've created this world with your own imagination, although there's all these people that say she, you know, derived, robbed everything out of English literature. Well. But she created this world that people believe in, so it's possible to have collaborators because they know what muggles do and they know what the spells are.
Yes.
I do wonder why she was so successful. It was almost like just that perfect alignment of stars and just perfect timing because her ideas weren't that original, and she wasn't that fantastic a writer either, so it was just that, you know.
I remember somebody's criticism of her being that she sort of massacred the adverb, and after they told me that, I couldn't really read it the same because you just notice it all the time, how she'll have a series of them, you know, in a sentence.
Which incidentally reminds me of the Isabel Carmody session we did a few weeks ago. She said things which you would never tell school children. Yeah. Like, you know, just use as many words as you like.
I thought when she was listening, it was exactly the opposite advice that you give. You know, words have power. Choose your words carefully. Blah blah. But I think really Isabel doesn't realise her own power with language in saying something like that because she actually does choose the perfect word. Whereas you know when you're trying to bring that on in kids.
Now, in the Harry Potter play, the characters would be 30 years old now, would they?
No, what they do, they centre around the children of Harry and Ginny, you know, you remember?
New generation.
Harry married Ginny Weasley. And actually, it's very clever because the very last film ends with Harry sending off his middle son to Hogwarts on, you know, on the platform 9 3/4 and all that sort of stuff. And the child who's Albus, named after the, you know, Dumbledore.
They couldn't call him dumb.
it's such a twee sort of ending. I really hated that last chapter. Anyway, and he says to his dad, he's worried about going away to school. And he says, what if the sorting hat puts me in Slytherin? And he sort of says, you know, one of the bravest men I ever knew came from Slytherin. You know, so, and that is then used directly at the start of the play. You know, so it's a nice little segue into it. And the book is, and the play is all about this youngest, well, the middle child, Albus's experience at Hogwarts. So it's sort of typical J.K. Rowling's. Like it uses some of the devices from previous books. It uses the time turner that was, I can't remember which one that was in, but Hermione used it.
Hermione too, yeah.
So it uses that idea as the centre for the narrative, really. But it also explores the idea of someone, you know, a child having to live in the shadow of expectations created by their parents, you know, which happens to a lot of kids. Like, it might be that your parents didn't go to school or didn't go to uni and they want you to, or that your parents are rich and famous and you feel like you're average. And it can, you know, manifest in a whole lot of different ways. So, you know, Albus is troubled by the fact that he's been put in Slytherin and he's not living up to the, you know, heroic Harry Potter, you know, son of Harry Potter sort of idea.
Is Harry still the figure that he was in the first books? Like,
oh, no, he doesn't do anything.
No, but the children, when they hear the surname Potter, are they?
Oh, yeah, they're well aware of. They talk about the Battle for Hogwarts as, you know, that that's an historic event that they all know about and that sort of thing. And the child of Ron and Hermione, of course, she's also there.
I didn't know
they paired up. No, that happens at the end of the last one. She's also there, and of course, she's everything. She's the captain of the Quidditch team, and, you know. Yeah. So Albus feels that he's a failure. Yeah. So he makes friends with, wait for it, Draco Malfoy's son.
Is there a Longbottom? Is there a Neville Longbottom?
No, I don't think so. But he does come into the story because of this time travel thing. But, I mean, that was all really, and I started to read it and I thought, oh, my, I'm not going to be able to stomach this. It's just too neat and tied up. But it did generate interest. But, you know, the story itself is quite interesting.
Is it hard to read as a play, though? I mean,
well, it wasn't for me because, like I said, the whole series for me was just finding out what happened. I just wanted to know what happened. So I just rode through all that.
Pushed
through until I found out what happened, and it was epic.
I wonder, is it selling, I wonder, in the same volume as the novels?
I don't think so. I saw a display in a, you know, one of those shops in Geelong, and they had plenty of copies there.
I'm sure the play tickets are. Was it that one? There was some charge about scalping tickets, and they weren't allowing people with scalped tickets in. And they paid thousands for some of the tickets.
Well, Finlay Burns Fab, an alma mater of the Apollo Base School, who's heading to London as a paramedic, told me that he has already established that you can't get tickets for a year and a half.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
but Finlay will find a way.
So,
how long is he there?
He'll devote himself to it.
It's become one of those London institutions.
Oh, there's Harry Potter worlds. Like, there's like a Disneyland you can go to in California, in Japan. Like, it seems obscene. It's gotten bigger than I would have ever imagined.
Yeah.
Just the sales were a small percentage, really.
It's funny how you were saying before about, you know, right time, that sort of thing. Because I'm old enough to remember there was a similar phenomenon with the Sue Townsend, you know, the Diary of Adrian Mole.
Yes.
And that was in a play. And when I was teaching at school, I tried to get kids interested in this, which had been a huge seller. Very funny. Not interested.
I read it and I enjoyed it, but it had a lot more references to its period, whereas Harry Potter didn't.
Mm.
It was timeless in that way. So,
and it was a bit smart alecky and
a very British.
Yeah, yeah.
If you hadn't watched, like I watched all those, you know, afternoon shows, Press Gang, and all of those English comedies. If you didn't have that dialect, I don't think you would have even picked up on Adrian's sarcasm.
Yeah,
yeah. So it was a very strong narrative.
Yes. Now, speaking of people who have plundered popular stories and made a career out of it, I've been given a book, actually, on William Shakespeare. And this was a gift, and thank you, Les. But it's quite one of those beautiful coffee table books, kind of, you know. And it's just got all the plays and, you know, everything you wanted to know. It's just a beautiful coffee table book. And isn't it nice sometimes to have a book you can dip in and out of, you know, that you can just read it for 5 minutes and then
There'll be references to all sorts of, I mean, I haven't read all of Shakespeare's plays, and there'll be references to ones in it to be able to look it up.
Yes.
And even ones that you have read, you know.
Yes.
You'll hear a name and you think, oh, I think that's a character in one of Shakespeare's plays.
Yeah. Yes. Over the years, people have given me a few Shakespeare books. I've got a little Shakespeare library now. and of course, you know, over the years you teach the usual ones, you know, so got a nice little Shakespeare library. Last time I told you about the Stephanie Plum novels, and I'm getting through this one. I think we're up to...
So did she get her man, the bounty hunter?
No, but the tension's rising. And the body count is at 7, and the nice detective has brought her beer and pizza twice now. And she's only burst into tears once. she's been caught in the rain a few times. She's had... she's been in a car chase where dead body fell off the top of the car in front of her.
Oh, yes.
and when she's in trouble, you know, the mysterious ranger, who's the professional bounty hunter, comes to the rescue. So we've got a little bit of tension. Which one does she like, the nice policeman or the tough bounty hunter?
I'll go the tough bounty hunter. He'll turn out to be nice.
So they are the Stephanie Plum novels written by Janet Ivanovich. And I noticed that the Apollo Bay Community Bank has a book sale, and there are plenty of Stephanie Plum novels on the shelves for $1 each. So I snaffled up a few. I'm afraid to say I haven't made much progress with Burial Rites.
Oh, I love that.
Well, I'm sure I will like it. And
you haven't made progress, not because you're not enjoying it. You just haven't had time.
Just been doing other things. Yep. But I kind of like this notion of you get this sort of stern Christian orthodoxy in these Northern European countries.
Mm.
And... it's all mixed up with patriarchy and conservative political values. And be no surprise for the reader to learn that the women get a tough time under these social values. And in a stern Christian community, how much actual love and compassion is there?
That sort of in that context too of that wild, difficult environment where humans feel like they're just holding on, you know, like it's not a natural place for people to be living.
Yeah, and
it was almost not justifiable, but it's much more understandable to see someone harsh in that environment than someone like in the Crucible who's living in a pretty much new world paradise.
I think I've read an interview, I think, in which the author, Hannah Kent, was making that point about it's the kind of landscape which hardens people's sensitivities a bit.
She's just published her second book. I don't know what it's called. I can't remember it. I saw it mentioned somewhere. I thought it'd be interesting. Because, you know, the origin of that one was she went on an exchange. And so I wonder where else she went.
And isn't it interesting that a young woman from Victoria, was she?
South Australia,
she, as a teenager, she had this thing about Iceland. Where did that come from?
Yeah.
Mm.
Björk.
And stumbled ABC across this dramas. True story. We should remind people this. It is a true story.
Yeah. Yes.
Or it's a novel based on a true story.
Mm. It's been on the Year 12 list.
Mm. Yes. It's about the execution of an Icelandic woman in 1824 after having been convicted of murder. And I'm sure it's a ripping yarn. So, any more news on current reading?
Halfway through two, I'm just trying to Google, I can't remember the name of the second one. I'm halfway through Stoner by John Williams, which is, I've read more and more references to it. It's one of those sleeping classics, they say, that's been sitting idle for a long time. It's nice slow build up, but I'm enjoying it. And then something else popped up that's a nice little read, and I jumped into that and finished half of it last night. It it was the one that was reviewed on ABC Book Show the other night.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
The Night of Our... Is it the Night of Our... Night of Our Souls or... Our Souls of the Night, and I cannot remember the name
about
of it.
The two.
I'll bring it next week when I finish.
About
it.
The elderly couple, who strike up a
It's like talking about English. It begins with and. And the night that
you do anything Maggie, when you're famous.
Yeah, Aggie turned up to his house. But yeah, she approaches a widow in the same block of houses as her and says, "You know, I've got a proposition for you. How about we just lie beside each other and sleep and chat in the night?" And it's just, yeah, it is. It's very nice. It's very easy to read. A lot of it is very just dialogue, but without any punctuation whatsoever. So it's a only a couple of times I've had to think, is she thinking that or saying that? But it's very, very easy to read and quite small.
And I can see a similarity between that and Love in the Time of Cholera.
I was just going to say the same thing, that idea of the layers and the expressions of it's physical closeness.
It's such it's an epic love story, though. It's so much bigger. This one's just,
This is The Book Show on Apollo Bay Radio. The term magic realism apparently has been used since 1925. The German art critic, apparently, Franz Rohe, used the term to distinguish it from surrealism. And I believe the Italian writer Massimo Bontempelli applied it to...
Doesn't he play for Footscray?
Plays for the Bulldogs. But since the 1950s, it refers principally, but not exclusively, to Latin American literature. Although Salman Rushdie, is that the correct pronunciation?
You're the expert.
And even Tim Winton have dabbled in magic realism. But it's literature in which magic is presented as an unremarkable part of the world. How else could we define magic realism?
Tim Winton was really interesting talking about it. He said, when he was asked about why do you do that, why put that in there, that fantastical stuff when you're doing such sort of realistic portrait of suburban life. And he was saying, just how can anybody dispute that strange things happen?
Yes.
You know, cats turn up in other states. It's a part of life, and he felt like he had to put it in there because it's just strange things do happen in the world.
Yes. Well, I can just run through a couple of the apparent characteristics, and the critics will say that, is it Borges, the Argentinian, who renovated the language of fiction to enable this kind of stuff. And this kind of stuff includes fables, folk tales and myths, which are then applied to contemporarily relevant themes. Fantasy traits are given to characters, where they have telepathy or they levitate or something. Supernatural realms blend with the natural and the familiar, and as we said, they are presented as unremarkable things. One of the characteristics is that the authors don't draw attention to the supernatural nature of things. They just occur as anything else might occur. There's a kind of layering of cultures, especially in the work of Marquez, the Colombian writer, where so many layers, we might come to that in a minute. There are sort of hybrid settings and places. There is metafiction in the sense that you're not sure which is the narrative and which is, what's the reader's role in this, or do the characters sometimes step out of the narrative? Heightened sense of mystery and a political critique, often allegorical or metaphorical. So there's a lot to talk about in magic realism. But Lee, you and I both have battered copies of 100 Years of Solitude, published in 1967. We would have both read it in the early 70s, I suppose.
Can't even remember.
Which is a very long time ago,
that's probably
Lee.
Why. Can't remember.
And it tells the multi-generational story of the Buendiar family, who founded this fictional city in the metaphoric country of Colombia. So I haven't read it for a long time, but I just do remember this, all the sort of mythology that you trace through these seven generations, and all of the important events in the history of Latin America, the indigenous people, the colonialists, then the sort of landed gentry, the industrialists, the impoverished workers. It's all woven into the story. It's as if
through the family.
Yeah, it's as it's the kind of a literature by which South America reads its own history in a way.
Yeah, and like you say, there's so many layers to it, because there's all that. You're sort of aware of that as a reader without knowing the history yourself, that these are progressing. The history is progressing because you think the train comes and things like that. You know that time is changing, not just for the family but for the civilization in which they live in. But beyond that, it's the story of humans and that keep repeating the same mistakes.
Yes.
You know, and that's what's. Yes. So, and he uses such interesting devices to make that clear to you. Like the children are all named the same, so it's almost impossible to work out who they're talking about. You know?
My copy had a very, very handy family tree.
Oh yeah, they do
at
do
the
that.
Start.
But it doesn't matter because they're all called the same thing.
But I actually ended up writing notes beside it to try and still keep track. But
But it's as if they're cursed in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's something that you get this sense that people can't escape their own proclivities or their, you know, their own flaws. Even
or fate, as it would put it forward, that it was already predetermined.
And
it ends in the same place it began. There's that circular notion to the whole cycle.
Yes.
But there's also such strong sense of the human foibles, you know? It's not just that it's in that family, it's humans.
Yes.
And you really have to read it to explain it, because it's like a paragraph begins with just a mention of a character and then you're off. You're on with that character for a few pages. And you go through sort of all their events of their life, and then another paragraph begins and you're off with someone else.
Yeah.
It's such a journey.
And I remember a sense in which there are sympathetic characters who had nevertheless done some terrible things.
Oh, yeah, you know?
You get this sense that, it's all just part of the human experience, you know, and at the end of your life you hopefully are a better person than you were 40 years ago when you used to steal and cheat and lie and all that sort of stuff.
But also, the way Shakespeare, the things that he explores in human nature are so elemental, you know, like jealousy and, you know, revenge and ambition and all those sort of things. Well, Gabriel Garcia Marquez does that as well, you know, like things that people do are such human things, you know, like
having power over their daughters.
Yeah, or holding, you know, making, you know, one of the women makes her sister suffer. Because the guy that she liked favoured her first. So she spends her life with this iciness in her heart, you know.
Yes.
And it's just, and then, you sort of realise that's the mistake that she's made in her life. And then all these other characters with other things that they've done in their lives that have caused them to take the path. And then there's this fabulous great-grandmother, they think, you know, supposed to be about 120 years old, Ursula. She's just, you know, like the colonel comes back and he's fought 32 wars. And she really gets him down. If you're still here, still doing this, when I come back in the morning, I'll pull your pants down and smack you. It's just fantastic.
And the colonel, he's fought in those 34 wars, fathered 17 sons by unknown women.
And they're all called the same thing. They're all Orlana or something, and they've got their mother's names.
Yes. And don't, Aureliano.
Yeah.
And don't they all die violently and mysteriously before 35? Yeah. Mm. I mean, gosh, what a grand. And at the end of the story, Megan, as you were saying, there's this sort of myth of the curse that
all the way tail. Through,
and then the pig's tail at the end.
Yeah, that's the incest.
And the way he talks about the family and all of their foibles, as you were saying, though, it's it feels that they're all very accepting of all of their errors, and it's almost, even insanity. You can imagine that's just one of the family. It's just another branch of who we are. And it doesn't seem to have that moral lesson that you feel like you get in Shakespeare. Yeah. Instead, the characters suffer their own consequence.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Rather than you know, feeling there's a hero or a good guy or a bad guy, everyone's just all a little bit screwed up.
Yes.
And we're all accepted as all being a little bit screwed up. Yeah. And I just loved so much of the story. And I have to reread. I haven't reread it in a long time.
I wonder if that's some of the charm of it in, you know, it was published late 60s.
Mm.
This is 100 years of solitude. And in the 70s, we were trying to get away from this sort of judgmental, orthodox
families
way
have
of,
to be in
of
a
looking at
form.
Things. Mm. And maybe that's why that book was so popular, because the narrative voice is not judgmental.
But the other thing I think about the way Gabriel Garcia Marquez writes is he's quite unique in that he uses smell quite often in a way that other writers don't do.
Yes.
He's very evocative of that sort of South American lifestyle, you know, the house where they live and the description of it and the people coming and the food and all that sort of stuff. You get that real immersion in that sort of Latin American culture. But also smell. And he makes characters, as part of their sort of attraction to one another, they'll talk about their smell. You know, that one has this smoky smell and it just sort of drives them mad, and they're lying at night and they're still. And, you know, someone commits, I can't remember which one this was, but they die and the smell of gunpowder won't go off them, and they end up having to seal his tomb because it's permeated through the whole.
The alchemist as well, doesn't all the smells from his little chemistry experiments remain in that space? And
But I think that idea of smell is really interesting.
Yes, because you don't get it in novels as much as you should.
But we all have it, don't we? Like the smell of your grandmother's house.
Or they say it's one of the strongest forming first memories that you have.
Yes.
My kids, I've always worn the same perfume, and mum, and one of my kids said to me the other week, "Oh, that's your mummy smell."
Thought,
well, that's sealed that. You don't have to wear that forever. Otherwise, it won't be mummy.
And there is, I haven't read it, but I know there's a famous scene in Love in the Time of Cholera about the man, is it Florentino's, infatuated with Femina. And doesn't he eat the flowers which remind him of her smell?
And there's another one in that. I've got one I was going to read out of this one. You know, when he describes that heat is the other thing that he describes so well, that sort of stifling humidity and the prickling on the back of your neck, the sweat. And then he describes him dressing in his linen shirt using rose water and stuff to disguise the smell from the sweat. And it's just really earthy.
That heat, that humidity does amplify that as well. Crazy. So all of those smells, but even food, fruit in humidity will smell stronger than it would in our climate right now. So it's more amplified, I'm assuming, where he's from as well.
The bit I was going to read was just, it's from 100 Years of Solitude, if I can find. I just loved, amongst the whole story, you get all these little insights into human nature. And this was just when they were talking about something being lost. So I'll just read this bit. So when she heard Fernanda, all upset because she had lost her ring, Ursula remembered that the only thing different she had done that day was to put the mattress out in the sun because Meme had found a bed bug the night before. Since the children had been present at the fumigation, Ursula figured that Fernanda had put the ring in the only place where they could not reach it, the shelf. Fernanda, on the other hand, looked for it in vain along the paths of her everyday itinerary without knowing that the search for lost things is hindered by routine habits, and that's why it's so difficult to find them. It's so true, isn't it? I had that argument. I know I left the car keys there because I always put the car keys there. Yes, but they're not there. So they're somewhere else.
I was thinking, when you were saying magical realism as well, I suppose the parallel I often see, other than someone like David Lynch, who puts it very much into his work, is the Japanese animation seem to just accept those fantastical things. And I don't imagine it's necessarily a Japanese society or Eastern view, but certainly for their children, that escape, there is a complete accepting of these fantastical characters that come out of, like, Spirited Away, and I can't remember I can't remember the director's name, but he has an entire studio, and they're all aimed on that sort of magical realism kind of idea.
You prefer, Megan, Love in the Time of Cholera?
No, I'm the other way. I like it, but I think 100 Years of Solitude is my ultimate favourite,
And what about you, Lou?
No, I was Loving the Time of Cholera just because when I read it, I had never read anything that was so focused on that detail of sensory detail and, you know, the context people were in. It's like time was slowed down because there was so much effort put into the description of you know, the environment, the heat, the smell of things. You know, it was just, it's so sort of luscious, the whole thing. 100 Years of Solitude skips along at a great pace. Like,
jumping decades.
Yeah. There's so much happening. You've just got to keep yourself really sharp. Mm. Whereas I think Love in the Time of Cholera is much slower and much more, I don't know, in the moment.
Well, would I be right in thinking that in Love in the Time of Cholera is really a story about two different approaches to love. Mm. The two different characters, one's a passionate man, perhaps not all that realistic, perhaps too sentimental. The other one's a very matter-of-fact, business-like, efficient, and he's the doctor who's addressing the cholera epidemic. Mm. So you get these two approaches. And the woman goes with the sensible man for the first 50 years. For the first 50 years. And then makes her peace with the flawed, passionate man.
Yeah.
And that's such an interesting idea.
And I think that that similar idea is also in 100 Years of Solitude, really, because you have all these moments where people are completely, there's one story at the end, they're completely consumed by their passion, you know, and it just drives them mad. It's almost like a form of insanity.
Yes.
And then another type of love will replace that. There's one of the Arellanos, I can't remember which one, who has the woman in the house and he has his, mistress. And he continually swaps between the two of them.
Oh, yes.
And the mistress is the one that's really earthy and all around them, all the animals procreate all the time.
Yeah.
Like they have triplets.
Yeah.
This is the magical realism sort of stuff. Yeah. So, like, she's this sort of really earthy one. And the other one, Fernanda, I think her name is, she was brought up to think she was a princess. And she's really a very sort of puritanical but ordered, you know, and he swaps between the two. And when he gets to one place, he stays and he sort of gets involved and forgets about the other one, and then he swaps back.
Yes.
And I think maybe it's like, you know, what they say about, you'll have more than three careers in your lifetime now. And like that lady that was at the Writers' Festival that you read, that there are different types of love.
Yes.
And you may experience that with the same person. Or
you usually only just have one at a time.
Yes, or with you know, different people in a kind of a serial sort of a way. We're different phases of your life, perhaps.
Mm.
You
need Well, in the end, this Aureliano goes back to the mistress, the earthy one, but all their sort of the sensuousness has gone out of their relationship, and they're just companionable then in their older age.
Yes. Isn't that interesting the way he does that?
Mm.
And the in Love in a Time of Cholera, is it Florentino? He declares when the woman rejects him, Firmina, she rejects him, that he's going to be faithful to her for the rest of his life. And he thinks that he is, despite his 15,000 lovers.
Yes.
And declares that he is, and believes that he has been.
Yeah.
And somehow that makes sense.
Yeah. That, it's almost like that sort of idea of love.
Yeah.
You know, is almost separate stream. You know, that this is the person that you love, and then life takes you on this other journey.
Yes, that's right.
Nakes explores all those different colours of relationships, and I think that's what it's a human story, but it's also really interesting because it's it allows for that deviation from the norm, like we were saying, the house full of crazy people.
Mm.
Yes. The word cholera in Spanish means both the disease and also passion.
Mm.
So Love in the Time of Cholera is actually a pun.
Yeah. You know? And also that sort of confusion between love and a disease, like love and
love
something. And I was going to say too about the magical realism in it. I think almost like one of the ways Marquez uses it is like it's like our memory. You know how our memory is sort of so flawed. You know, and people exaggerate their stories about the size of the fish they caught, and you know, that sort of stuff.
And what
but it's
a good
like that.
They used to be.
Great teacher.
Yes. Sorry.
Good cook. All the things you want. It's like that. That is that sort of the magic is sort of like the collective understanding of our history, and it's got something to teach them, and it doesn't really matter that it's not.
Well,
it's not what you imagine.
That's such an interesting thing that somehow you need the magic in the story in order to get to the truth.
Yeah, yeah.
I find that so interesting that you kind of need, well, it's not falsehood, but you need myths and fables in order to tell the truth about real life.
Well, you know, Tim Winton, who also uses magic realism in Cloud Street, he does that. He uses the black fella, he calls them. The kids were very offended by that when we were teaching him. We were saying that was a term that was used, you know. So Winton is just using the language of the time. But he appears and he links the idea of the suffering, you know, of the Aboriginal people and the way they've been treated with the suffering of the house.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's a device that allows him to explore something through time.
Yes.
You know, which he wouldn't have been able to do in that sort of, I don't know, easy way that pops up throughout the text. And I think that's some of what Marquez does too.
Yes, and Marquez, in accepting his Nobel Prize, said...
Thanks.
Our crucial problem has been a lack of conventional means to render our lives believable.
Mm-hmm.
This, my friends, is the crux of our solitude. Gracias. That is an interesting thing to say, though, isn't it? Yes.
You could spend quite a lot of time talking about his understanding of solitude.
Mm.
You know? It reoccurs all the time. And I think in that example I was given before, they talk about the two of them together in their separate solitudes, you know, as a way of an effective relationship.
Yes. And the inevitable fact, the inescapable fact, that it's in the end, it's going to be solitude.
Mm.
And all... through your life, all the things that happen to you, you, in a sense, you suffer them alone.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, and that's it.
Mm.
It's an interesting idea, especially when you pair that with then how you share yourself, you know, which is this other great idea about relationships and, and love.
And one of the other things in his books is this hope that perhaps, you know, the socialist governments will perhaps redress some of the wrongs. And that's often represented symbolically as whether it's the House of Mirrors or whatever. But we don't always end hopefully, do we?
Yeah. No, and he certainly, through the character of the colonel, the one that fought the 34 world wars, he sort of mouths those almost exactly when at different stages when things are going badly, he says, so this is what this was about. It was about pride. You know, and then he says later on when he has to sign a peace document that, so this is what it's just about, power, you know. It's all about power. We will give them what they want so that we can retain some power. It wasn't ever about our ideals, you know. So he's quite clearly that sort of history of failed democracies.
And I imagine something which it takes a lifetime to learn. I've been inspired, Lee. I'm going to have to reread Gabriel Garcia Marquez.
Particularly if you paired it with a trip to South America, I think that would be an excellent thing, Brian.
Do you think that perhaps because of our climate and our heritage, there's something missing in these cool climates where we live in a sophisticated culture, and perhaps some of the earthiness of Latin American life is lost to us.
Yeah. Well, some of the sort of passion and that sort of ridiculousness, the things that people do, you know, it's like the mad dogs and Englishmen out in the midday sun, you know, the things that people do in a climate that's, you know, stifling heat, you know. And he really captures that. But I think his success is just that he's such a different sort of writer, you know. And, you know, when you're sort of thinking about things to read, it's really easy to churn along and, you know, the path of known authors, things you like and stuff like that. But when you go back and read a classic, sometimes reminds you of why they're classics, you know. They're just so brilliantly done and they just, you know, sparkle and with their difference.
Often think about some of the famous American writers, and every one of them, I remember thinking, every one of them changed American literature.
Mm.
Melville, Mark Twain, Fitzgerald, and then Norman Mailer. And literature was, and you could put, what's his name in there? I'll come back to me in a minute. Literature was never the same after them and could never be the same. They influenced everyone who followed them. Baldwin's the other, was it? Anyway, they influenced everyone who followed them, and as indeed this man has.
Yeah. And, you know, just reading the start of 100 Years of Solitude, you just realise you're on a completely different journey. This is not following your typical narrative setup.
Yes.
I wonder about South Americans reading it, though, and wonder if they just slip into it like an old, you know, comfortable kind of fable format too. It's much more accepted by them.
Mm.
I mean, it's been translated much more, I think, than any other South American writer. But I imagine he's similar to others from
Faulkner was the man I was trying to think of.
Oh, yes.
Yes. Well, thank you for those comments. We've been discussing Gabriel Garcia Marquez, the Colombian writer, and magic realism. Next week, we thought we might move into crime fiction and perhaps true crime as well. I have a weakness, I must say, for both, but I had a little true crime phase.
Did you? I can't go near true crime.
Or is it just too ghastly?
Isn't it ridiculous? I can read crime, but it has to be something that's really happened.
But isn't that some of the attraction of crime writing? Is that it's not real, and there's a psychological function which we might think about for next week. Is that, as Agatha Christie used to say, people like my books because it reassures them that order will always be restored. And is that one of the attractions?
I've just always felt sort of a bit, you know, if you see those true crime sections in bookstores and stuff, it just all feels a bit ghoulish, you know, almost voyeuristic to read, you know, like when something comes out like about a serial killer, you think,
That's true.
I don't want to know about you.
Yes. And what about Underbelly?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's sort of... that's different, I reckon, because
it's more readable.
Yeah, because it's also so local. Yeah, you know.
Yes,
you hear places and things where you've sat, driven past.
That's right. Yes, there's some really funny parts of Underbelly too.
Yeah.
About the incompetence of criminals. I mean, they really are funny. But we probably all have our favourites. There's Christie we've talked about. There's P.D. James. There's some people either, love her or just won't read her. P.D. James. I like those sort of trashy kind of femme crim American styles. You know,
It's your guilty pleasure, Brian.
Or Sue Grafton I quite like too, you know. Not as funny as this, but she's... kind of spirited feminist detective, and good fun.
Yeah.
Good fun.
Well, there's quite a lot. Probably that would be one where we have more, less intricate discussion of books and more names going here, there, and everywhere.
Yes. And I'm sure Lynn Halloran is a fan.
Oh, is she?
A crime fan.
Fade in the background. I've only just put toe in the water.
All of this and more on the next book show on Apollo Bay Radio. Megan Harrison, thank you so much for your company. Lee Kelly, hope to see you next week.
Thank you.
And wherever you are, take care and we'll catch you again on Apollo Bay Radio.